Started. Welcome, everybody. On the screen, you see the usual lineup of rules and etiquette that we like to go by in these meetings. I just want to call your attention to the fact that the meeting is recorded and we post the audio on the agenda webpage and the chat line soon thereafter. Okay. So I just have almost hardly any announcements, but it's actually pretty important. So as you know, hanging off the Senate are tons of committees, tons of behind the scenes work. Next slide, Jill. This is the lineup of people who have signed up to help us out, help us deliver, you know, shared governance and to deal with all the issues that come our way. So just a hats off to that group of people, and we really appreciate that. There are a couple of slots that are still open, and it's an occasion to contribute in probably pretty significant ways. So FACTA is an advisory committee to the provost that looks at all the tenure cases. Hanging off the University Assembly are two important committees, one on codes and judicial, the campus code of conduct and campus infrastructure. And then we need some folks to, on the review board. So I just put those up there. You may get a call from somebody at some point. Okay, next slide. So our first order of business today is concerned with one of the RTE titles, the PO, Professor of the Practice. And as you know, there are university level rules about how a college delivers that title. And the College of Business, which as you know, is about three or four years old now, was a synthesis of three units, each of which had their own POP policy. And here to tell us how the JCB is unifying these is Deputy Dean Andrew Corallia. Andrew.
Thank you, Charlie. Hello, everybody. Thank you for this wonderful opportunity to come before you. I promise to keep my remarks short, but start by saying, looking at the list of volunteers from the Senate and all the important things that they do, you should know how much all of us thank you for your service to the Senate and all the things that you do for the university. As Charlie mentioned, and thank you, Jill, she's running the slides. You can go right ahead to the next slide if you don't mind, Jill. The basic background here is that we are now in the fifth year following our merger, which took place on July 1st to form the College of Business. We are an amalgamation of three schools with long distinguished legacies, the Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management, the Johnson Graduate School of Management, and the School of Hotel Administration. As you can imagine, dear friends on this call, some of you know may know intimately, we have been working hard in the last 4 years to harmonize many policies and procedures that run the gamut in each of the three schools towards creating a college. We inherited as a legacy three separate professor of the practice policies. They were different on different dimensions. What I'd like to say is that we had initiated through our newly elected body within the College Faculty Policy Committee, they 2 years ago took it upon themselves to try to figure out some sort of common policy that we could build from this. So Charlie, in the next slide, Jill, Charlie asked me, could you relay, given that our senators know well the policy at the university level, can you relay some of the interesting concerns, discussions, debates that took place along the way that were featured in as we came to where we are today? So first was clearly the definition of what we meant by a professor of the practice. As you will see in the policy that we have shared with you as a pre-read, we worked hard to be close to the language and spirit of the Senate resolution of an experienced leader who has held positions in business, professional, entrepreneurial, and so on in other non-academic organizations. But for our college, given that a number of faculty had been appointed without necessarily those attributes, but had had significant high level or specialized teaching experience, we wanted to, or our policy allows for some balance between those two types of individuals, or those two types of attributes. Another example of something that drew a lot of discussion in our college faculty policy committee was about the issue of reclassification or migration. In the business school world at large, in the world at large, there is the appointment of a faculty member to a professor of the practice title is something that is considered an important lever to give advantage from a competitiveness standpoint. And while it is clearly understood in the legislation at the Senate level, the resolution, as well as in our language, that it is not intended to be seen as a promotion from a lecturer or senior lecturer title, or extension or research associate title for that matter, our business school world definitely sees it that way and exploits it that way. So a lot of discussion revolved around that. You can see where the policy came out in the end. Another thing that was different across the three schools was the restrictions that the respective three schools had put on the cap, the number of faculty that could aspire to this title relative to the total faculty complement. Some schools had more stringent caps, others less stringent. We decided that we would impose a cap of 25% of the tenure track faculty as the overall cap for the college, but then, as a compromise, allowed for school-specific limits to be more stringent in their caps, depending on their need or legacy. And then finally, I should mention, before Jill turns to the next slide, about voting rights. So it turns out each of the three schools had very different provisioning for voting rights on admission to faculty, promotion, tenure, advancement, and relative to other RTE titles. And so there was a lot of interesting discussion about how that would play out. So, Jill, last slide. I mentioned the first bullet that we started this about 2 years ago. I would say there were two major revisions through the spring of 2020. I should commend Charlie for always being there to lend an ear and thoughts as I reached out to him along the way. Thank you, Charlie. Eventually, on March of this year, our College Faculty Policy Committee, the nine members, plus me ex officio, the nine members voted to support the policy that you've seen before you. And then we present the chair, Donna Hager, the chair of that CFPC, then presented it to the faculty at large for a discussion and vote on April 9th. And we had a vote that followed thereafter. They had about a week to vote, and we had 101 voting in favor, 27 opposed, 17 an abstention, and the reported electorate was 151 tenure track, 65 RTE. So I will stop there, Charlie and Jill. Thank you for your help. Any questions that are coming can come my way. I mean, I'm more than happy to answer them.
Charlie, you're muted.
I just want to remind the senators that we aren't voting on this today. The resolution and supporting documents are online, and we'll give you a reference to those in the synopsis, and you can post comments and concerns at that point. Bruce Lewinstein has his hand up. Bruce.
Thanks, Charlie, and thanks, Andrew. Just a quick question about the 27 votes in opposition. What were the concerns that were expressed by some other faculty?
Thank you, Bruce. That's a great question. They ranged in various different forms. I would say the slide, if you could go back one, Jill, many of the arguments in opposition revolved around issues to do with the caps, issues to do with whether we should have accepted this compromise of balancing the definitions. In fact, I would say the majority were a majority of those 27 opponents were very much focused on whether we should allow for this alternative attribute as acceptable for the title. But they ranged along those lines. These four bullets would represent the majority of those concerns.
Richard Benzel.
Hi, thanks for the presentation. The 214 tenure track and RTE faculty, 101 voted in favor. That means over half either opposed, were abstained, or didn't vote at all. Am I reading that right?
Well, we never pursued those that were not. We never pursued the why individuals did not respond to the vote opportunity, Richard. Many of these faculty, of course, are fractional FTEs. A number of them were on leave. Sabbatical leaves, granted sabbatical leaves. We probably had a good chunk of those as well. But I don't have the answers to the breakdown on the complement that you're describing. Certainly off the top of my head.
Okay. Chris Schaefer, then Risa, and then we have to move on. Chris.
Yes, hi, this is Chris Schaefer. Just following up on that previous question, what are the rules for business in the College of Engineering? Does this vote, as it was conducted this way, represent an official perspective of the faculty or not? I think if we're asking the Senate to act on that, it's important to understand under what conditions this vote was taken, was quorum met, like, is this an official vote or is this an informal thing that was done with, you know, 50% participation at a meeting?
It's a good question. I can't say that it's officially a quorum or not a quorum, because I'm not sure that we've actually officially, in our 4 years experience, actually defined what is a quorum, but that's a great question, Chris. Be happy to follow up on that.
And Risa.
Yeah, thank you. I have a question about the breakdown of the vote to add. The rules about the vote, my understanding is that there has to be we have to know, was there a two-thirds positive vote of the tenure track faculty who voted, tenure track tenure faculty who voted, as well as a two-thirds positive vote of non-tenure track faculty who voted? Plus there's another provision, but that was the one I had a question about.
A great question. Unfortunately, we didn't parse out the votes in favor or opposed or an abstention according to whether they were tenure track or RTE. We didn't do that. We treat all of our faculty as equal members before the electorate.
I understand that. I'm talking about the rules that were originally the clinical faculty.
Back in the day. Then, I can't answer that.
I'm talking about the rules originally were for how to vote on clinical faculty. My understanding that would have been the same rules with regard to the Senate approving it for professor of the practice, unless that changed, and I don't remember that. Maybe Charlie had that information.
Honestly, it's simple majority. Like, for example, we did the thing with the law school last year, and then over the last few years, lots of these votes, to my knowledge, it's always been just simple majority. It's never been close in the sense that whether 50% or two-thirds mattered, but we can research the voting rules there, and if you're alluding to something that's in the enabling legislation, I'll certainly do homework to make sure we get it right.
Yes, yeah, it is in the enabling legislation for clinical faculty, and I assumed it was the same for when it was changed to professor of practice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll certainly check on that. Okay, thanks, Andrew.
Thank you, Charlie. Appreciate it.
We'll return to this. And again, for at least the next meeting's in 3 weeks. So for at least that period of time, this will be up there for commentary and we'll respond to questions. Okay, Jill, let's get on to the next stuff. All right, so changes to the Code of Academic Integrity. We hardly ever do this, but last spring, because of its unique nature, brought to light several concerns that, in a way, demand some kind of action. So there are three of them, and what I'd like to do is talk through each one in turn, and then pause and see to solicit questions and so on. So, Jill, the next slide. But before we get into that, here's sort of the approval process. And back in the summer, I thought, hey, let's be systematic and just work down that list sort of But then I said, let's do it all at once. These are all the groups that should weigh in on this. And I think there's value in actually doing it simultaneously, because then we get to see how each other thinks. So the process then is to get more feedback today. There's a lot of stuff online already. Then we feed all that to the Educational Policy Committee, who will then shape everything into three resolutions that we will then vote on. So the first one here is concerned with the independent witness. This is not a witness of support. This is someone who simply sits in on the meeting and can attest to the professional handling of what goes on. And given that we now do these by Zoom, the proposal here is we don't need an independent witness. Just Zoom, record the audio and video, and that becomes the record of the meeting. If it has to be referred to in a in an appeal, so be it. So that's the basic proposal. Unless the student and the, let's go on to the next slide, because here are some of the concerns you might want to have. So there's some concern that recording captures too much, right? And if I'm the faculty member, I better get it just right, or otherwise we'll have a big legal problem on our hand. Then there's the issue about recording it at the appeal. I would assume that would be okay if one wanted to go over what was said. They're very interesting questions about figuring out who, getting at the truth. And Sherry Kalb in the law school pointed me to a really interesting article that she wrote about that. So that's maybe something that should be put in the hopper. And then there's the recording itself. We have to be very careful about confidentiality. Who has access to it? Where is it stored? And when would we expunge it? So let me pause right here. I must say, on the this one didn't seem to generate any big concerns. It seemed like a way of actually having the workload, at least in terms of the primary hearing, that we would then just resort to Zoom or whatever recording capability may show up in the future. Any questions or concerns you'd like to see above and beyond what you see here? Oh, Risa.
Yeah, thanks. I can't remember if it's going to be addressed in the next slides, but I thought there was also, besides the issue of recording, which is, I think is, a good question about what happens to it, and privacy questions about whether that's permitted, but I thought there was also the question of having the witness, the person who's like the independent, witness there. And I think that is a real issue, that it does make a difference if you have another person present. It changes the nature of the interaction. Yeah.
So let's be real clear. The witness is simply a recorder, takes notes and so on. And to my, in my experience, and I've done a lot of these, never once has the witness's notes or whatever figured in anything afterwards. I mean, sometimes I might, after a hearing, chit-chat with the witness to make sure I got everything right. But the idea is, this is very separate from a witness that the student might bring or the faculty member might bring, okay? That, yeah. That doesn't touch that at all.
Yeah, I understand that. I'm just saying that I think there's a dynamic quality to having somebody else present.
Okay.
That may actually make a difference to the student, because it's scary if you're there with, the professor. So it's the dynamic quality, not the whether the person who's sitting there as an independent observer gets to say anything.
Okay, duly noted. Joni, and then Chris Schaefer. Joni?
Thanks. Yes, I was really just going to echo, I was going to say what Risa just said, that in, these issues, sometimes they are clear cut, but there are or are also instances where subtle manipulation or power issues might be complicating the issue. And in that case, I think that having just another live person present in the communication is important.
Thank you. Chris Schaefer.
Yes. Hi, Chris Schaefer from Biomedical Engineering. I just wanted to reiterate the point made by Risa and Joni. In these hearings, the faculty member is asked to play essentially the role of both a prosecutor and a judge, where you both put forward what you think transpired, you hear the defense, and you make a judgment about it. I think another person being there can provide either a real or at least the appearance of a moderating influence, where you take that unique responsibility to be both the prosecutor and the judge seriously and really listen to what the student has to say about the situation. So I would at least encourage this committee to think about the additional roles, even if they're not frequent, that another human may play in these hearings, especially when they become less than straightforward.
Good points. So we'll make a note of that. And you know, a possible option would be that if the student so chooses, you know, that's an option that can be exercised. Anyway, good points for the EPC when they get this. Let's go to the next one, because some of these issues actually come up here. So a primary hearing takes at least half an hour. That's the actual hearing, but the preparation for it and the post-hearing, whatever, it's time consuming, extremely time consuming. Now, what if you have a case that has 50 students? Are you going to say to the professor that you have to do every one of those? It may be physically impossible, okay? So the question here now is, when you have a large number of cases, and one of the parameters in this resolution is 3. If you have more than 3 students involved in the same case, then the instructor, with the approval of the department chair or equivalent, can have a designee who can then act as the, you know, in the primary hearing. Okay, so this would be a way to expedite with fairness a large case. Okay, so let's and then of course the instructor still makes these are all parameters to the resolution. The instructor still makes the decision, but obviously has a dialogue with the designee, and also can, if they afterwards, have a face-to-face meeting with the student themselves. Okay, so there are all those kinds of options. But what this does is open the door to handling very large cases. And I should say, you know, when you are looking at a situation and say, do I want to pursue this? And this really goes on. I know young professors who are being advised to look the other way, because these things take a huge amount of time. And if we make the load on the faculty so much, we're going to discourage the holding of academic integrity. So that's just below the surface here. We have to have a system that's fair and just, but also respects the huge amount of time that goes into these. Let's go on to the concerns that were voiced here. And one is, these things can have a tremendous educational value. I mean, I think especially like maybe a freshman who just sort of screws up, you have a talk and it really registers, and the takeaway is really of great educational value. And so with the designation, if you have a designee that's kind of subtracted off, okay, it's the face-to-face meeting with the instructor that can really affect the student's thinking in a positive way. And this sort of a paraphrase of the same thing, that if you create a space between the student and the instructor, and the instructor makes the ruling, it's a recipe for unfairness. Now, the Judicial Codes counselors, I'd like to thank them for giving really excellent comments on all 3 of these proposals. Brought up something that sort of surfaced in the last discussion, which is the way it is now, the faculty member is both judge and jury, so to speak. And ideally, you'd like to have a neutral party run the whole show under normal circumstances. And many other universities have a center where these cases are processed. All the faculty member does is sort of hand over the evidence, so to speak. So we don't have that. We can work towards that. But there you see the concern, the same kind of concern that surfaced in the discussions about the first change. So let me pause here and ask if any, do we have anyone from the JC, do we have a Judicial Codes counselor here who'd like to state this better than I can? Irene, thank you. So Irene is
here. Hi, everyone.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I'm a judicial codes counselor, and what we do is provide free service and advocate for students who are in trouble with academic integrity, Title IX, and campus code of conduct. So I think like you stated it pretty well, Charles, that like our concern a lot of the times in these things, and we never like think there's any ill will or like malicious intent on behalf of anyone here. Like I think it's just, you know, it's hard to be a neutral fact finder, but also have like a stake in how the outcome of the case comes, which is like, it's a difficult balance for professors to navigate. And, you know, our biggest concern is that it would be nice just like for all primary hearings and not just like primary hearings where a professor can't make it. Like we understand like how much of a heavy burden this is on for professors, especially for the large cases. But it would be nice just to have like a neutral person there to make the decision if they're going to delegate it to someone else. But even if you can extend that to when professors are actually dealing with the case themselves, of having like a neutral judge there to make the ultimate decision in the primary hearing. Because I think, you know, procedurally, it might also like lift the burden on people who are responsible for like secondary hearings, because I think it's like far and few for our office. Our clients don't typically want to go to secondary hearings. I think the ones that really push for the secondary hearings are the ones who feel like they come to us and they're like, I went to the primary hearing and it seems like the professor already made up their mind. It seemed like we've had clients who've told us, professors have specifically told them, you can't change my mind, I've already decided on this. So then it doesn't feel like they got a fair process. And so I think, you know, if it felt more fair in the primary hearing, at least like the optics of it, and like also we want to ensure it is more fair, it might also like lessen the administrative burden on you all, especially for like the secondary hearing boards, because I know there's a lot, and there's a lot pending from even last semester because of like the switch to COVID virtual learning. So I think that was our biggest concern. We thought it was a great suggestion to maybe just have like a neutral person there from the beginning for the primary hearing, if that makes sense.
Thank you, Irene. And again, thank you and your colleagues for working on this very important issue all these years and so on. Richard Bensel?
Yeah, just a simple question. This sounds like they're academic integrity hearings. Is there anything else covered under this proposal?
This is strictly academic integrity, stuff that happens in your class that shouldn't. Okay, so I think that the takeaway here is similar to the first one, but for the EPC to think about this neutrality thing, are we stuck with this judge plus jury thing? I know for years we've talked about having a place where you just hand over the case and that's it. I think we're probably, that's a big issue. I mean, a heavy lift, so to speak, where to pull it off is hard, but it's involved here. Anyway, so let's go on to the third one, which generated the most concerns. So here's the setting, and we had so much SU last semester. This is where this is coming from. So suppose an SU student does something, and now one of the standard sanctions is you lower a student by a half grade or something like that. And of course, if it's S or U, you don't have any wiggle room there. So the suggestion here is that the instructor has the authority to change the letter grade, change the grade option to the letter grade, and thereby administer perhaps a more reasonable sanction. So let's look at what the pushback was on this. So, Jill, next slide. Yeah, okay, so, this is a reasonable idea, but let the student decide, okay? So in other words, you would say to the student, do you want a U, if that's your choice, or some reduced letter grade? And if in the latter case, then the grade change option mechanism would be put in motion. Then there were the act of changing from SU to a letter grade can be a penalty, right? Because if you're doing an SU, you know, you aren't going for that A or whatever, you're just sort of skimming along. And so just changing to a letter grade might be a form of sanction. And so if you, on top of that, you reduce the letter grade, you're you're penalizing the student twice. But again, that comment concluded with let the student decide. I checked with the registrars, is it a big deal to do this? And this would be after the deadline. You know, there is a grade change option deadline. Is it a big deal to do this afterwards? It is a manual operation. However, from my standpoint, the time it would take a registrar to go in by hand and change the grade is probably one-tenth the time that the faculty member had to spend on doing the case. So I appreciate it, but the volume of cases wouldn't be so great that it would be a major headache for the registrars. But it's duly noted that it is a manual change. Okay, let's get Ken and then Joni. Ken Berman?
I was just curious to know, with this change to a letter grade, you seem to be presuming that they would change it and then give a student a B minus. I would have thought that you maybe want SUF, and if a student has violated integrity in a serious way, that there would be an argument that you should change their grade to an F, and or just say SUF are the choices with an SU student. Because, you know, when we're involved in these integrity cases and they're extreme, it seems to me that the student should see a genuine sanction. And if it's a serious enough matter, I think the F sends a message, an unexpungible F. I may sound very tough here, but computer science has a lot of these integrity cases. It's sort of easier to cheat in our field, and we've especially run into a lot of this recently. And to me, the appeal of saying if you cheat, you may have an unexpungible F on your transcript is substantial. I'm not trying to be unsympathetic, but the reality is that we need the students to be fearful of the consequences of cheating.
Okay, thank you. Joni.
Thanks. Yes, I'd like to actually get back to the point we just left. This is about the professor being judge and jury. And wanted just a little pushback in that, you know, we're also judge and jury when we teach our class. You know, that's what we do. You know, we assess how students perform in on the material. So this is bringing in a new dimension. What an ethical dimension of not just did the student do the work, has succeeded with the particular task, violated the ethical code. I think it's an addition, or it's a difference from our usual academic freedom assessments in our work, but it's not wholly different.
Okay, good point. Okay, seeing no more hands, but we're also out of time. So what I will do is package all this stuff up. I'm not sure what's on the, I'm not reading the chat, and give it to Professor Delchamps, who's chair of the EPC, and see what they come up with. And I'm not saying it's super urgent, but it would be nice to do this before we get too far into October, if possible. So a lot of good suggestions, and I'd like to thank everybody on that. Okay, Jill, let's do the a little intermission here. So we've kind of fallen behind in the approval of minutes thing here. So this would probably set a Guinness Book of Records in terms of the number of meetings you're going to approve all at once. So senators only, just on the chat line, say, I approve. I really don't know what to do if someone wants to quibble about what was said on June 3rd. Okay, but let's see if we can wrap these things up right now. So if you're a senator, simply go on the chat and say you approve these minutes, just so it's hardwired into the record and we can move on. Okay, so while you're voting on that, and I assume we have a quorum here, so let's go on now to the sort of the second half of the meeting, where we want to talk about two extremely important things. So one is the anti-racism initiative, and then after that, we'll have a pandemic-related session concerning the behavioral compact. So I want to give you, Nima and I would like to give you an update on where we are with this. I think it's really important that we do something like this every Senate meeting. We have something larger planned for the next meeting, which is in 3 weeks. And just a side note here, those of you who are familiar with Isaac and or Altshuler's and Kramnitz's book, there are two very relevant chapters that give you a perspective of what has gone on here at the university in the last, whatever it is, 70, 80 years. Chapter 5, Race at Cornell, Chapter 8, Academic Identity Politics. I mention this because we have to educate ourselves on this very complicated issue. And there you have a very nice sort of local history. Okay, next slide. So there, Martha's List has more than three items on it. The student's list of demands has more than three items on it. But these are the three that we have talked about in the last two meetings, and the focus is on them. And the takeaway here I want to stress is that they're all highly related, okay? As we'll talk about in a second, we're headed towards forming committees that are going to look into these things, but you cannot disentangle those three boxes. For example, the act of helping deliver the educational requirement for students may satisfy whatever it is, the educational requirement for faculty. How we turn to the center for staffing or advice or resources or whatever obviously touches the other two things. So to be clear at the start, these are highly, highly connected. And this is our focus, is on those three initiatives. Okay, I wanna say a little bit about how we are getting going in this business. So next slide, please, Jill. So as I mentioned, we're in the process of setting up committees. And there's some things I really wanna make sure we're clear on at the beginning. So right now, for the last month, Nima and I are, I'll just call it doing homework, right? That means looking into things. Nima will talk about going into the archives, looking at old task force reports, trying to understand what's been done. I've spent a lot of time recently just looking at the CAL's list of diversity courses, okay? We're doing a lot of homework now, and homework doesn't mean we're buying into one thing or the other. It's simply, let's get enough stuff on the table so that when we have our committees, they can work efficiently. We don't have to waste time looking for stuff, okay? So that's what we've sort of been doing the last couple of weeks. And I want to bring this up, and it's kind of hard to say, but you know, obviously, who's on a committee is extremely important. However, the more transparent that committee is, the less important it becomes. Let me give you an example. Here's the standard way of doing business. You appoint a gigantic blue ribbon committee, Cornell Chronicle article. Then there's 6 months of radio silence, and then another Chronicle article on the final report. Now, in that setting, I agree. You're in a locked room. Who's in that room is incredibly important. But if the channel to the broader community is free and back and forth, where you get to see what the committee is doing at every instant, you get to chime in with what they're working on, then yes, who's in that room is very important, but that person becomes more of a channel or an enabler. So this is a little bit of a point there, because I know this is a topic where everyone feels very strongly, and I just want to encourage a broad view about who's on this or that committee, okay? And finally, we have to be relaxed about charge and scope. For example, what is anti-racism, okay? Now, I, for one, I confess my ignorance. I sort of know what it's about. I know about the book and so on, but what is that? And does that define the scope of what we're trying to do here? I don't know, and I don't think any of us know, but we'll discover it. So I think when we talk about the charge and the scope of what we're doing, yeah, make a rough guess at this point, but be open to modifications as we sort of learn about it. So all these points are simply about a frame of mind that I'm trying to encourage all of us to have so that we can be productive and move on these particular issues. Okay, next slide, please. So I want, and Nima has spent a lot of time thinking about the center, and has a couple of slides here to bring us to another level of understanding of this. This is step one of 100 steps that we'll be having to take here. So Nima.
Thank you, Charlie. So like Charlie said, you know, this is a difficult issue that we've been asked to take up, and we want to be able to we're trying to do due diligence. And so we've been thinking very much about the center as a placeholder. So there's no form attached to it right now. And the idea really is that the committee that Charlie pulls together would which sort of acts as a channel to the larger community as well, students and faculty, that committee really becomes the place, the space, and the Senate becomes the space where we work through what this form is going to be. So we have a lot of examples across Cornell of different kinds of centers, and we can draw on what has worked and what we know doesn't work so well. And keeping in mind also what Charlie said about the linkages between the three charges that we're looking at, the educational requirement for students, the sort of, you know, some kind of an educational requirement for faculty, as well as, you know, what the center would do. So we know that we have issues with curriculum, even though the curriculum sits within colleges and departments, that's something that we're going to be looking at, maybe, maybe not. And we know we have issues with what's called compositional diversity. So a diverse faculty, for example. So we're just leaving that right now. You see that, you know, sort of we've got a couple of things there to just give you a sense that it could really be anything. So, but to continue to think of it as a placeholder. Similarly, you know, the language of anti-racism is also a placeholder. And I say that with a huge amount of hesitation because it feels like it's an abdication of responsibility, and that is not at all what one is talking about. What we're trying to sort of get at is that along with thinking about anti-racism, we need to think about questions of what it means to think about systemic racism, what it means to think about research into why this happens and why we've had it stay for this long. We need to think about how we teach. We need to think about how we decolonize, not just our minds, but our disciplines, and to think about the kind of climate we create at this university. So we're trying hard to hold these two very charged terms. We're trying to keep them in play, if that makes sense, without any loss of responsibility for what we have to do, or any loss of a sense of the importance, the historical importance of the ways in which sort of race has completely stripped entire communities of voice and of dignity. So Charlie, should I just go to the next slide? So there's a couple of things that we're doing. Like Charlie said, we've been trying to do our homework, and we thought it was really important to look at Cornell's institutional history of dealing with questions of racism, of colonization. And so we've pulled together a whole bunch of these reports. And what is striking, and I just want to read a couple of things, you know, here's a sentence, right, from one of the earliest reports. It says, "The time for committee discussion is past. The time for action is now." And this was written in 1968, and it could be true of today. And so what is striking after having sort of looked at all these reports is how the same three sets of initiatives keep coming up every time. So with every one of those committee reports, there is a call for changing the curriculum. With every one of those committee reports, there is a call for building a more diverse faculty. With every third one or so of those committee reports, there is a call for creating new programs, centers, the word sometimes forum comes up. So what was striking to us in reviewing these reports was why things did not happen. Why a task force's recommendations did not actually get implemented, or if they got implemented, why they got implemented in parts and not as a whole. So that is, you know, and a large part of it has to do with policies that don't have accountability built into them. And so a really important piece, it seemed to us in reviewing this, was to understand how we do that, how we think about the accountability piece and build that in. And the question of why a program disappears if suddenly the resource condition changes. So we cannot actually have, we cannot have a long-term transformation of the institution if it is so tied to a temporary pot of resources. So thinking about that resource question is also going to be quite central. The next slide, please, Jill. So we think it is really important to build on our current strengths, and we have considerable strengths in sort of, you know, this is just a very partial list. This is an open, you know, we've been writing to various programs across the university to say who in any part of the university that wants to be involved in this conversation, that sees itself as a, you know, as a partner in this conversation, needs to come to the table. It, the invitation is open to everybody. But there are great strengths in terms of scholarship in particular units. Where we've not done an equally good job is for units that don't appear, that don't sort of self-identify with thinking about how they wish to change, tend to remain outside. So the professional schools, the STEM disciplines, right, sometimes tend to feel that this is not a concern. So that's something I think that that's going to be a renewed conversation about how one really, especially when we talk about decolonization, how one really begins to think about our disciplines and how they're rooted in particular modes of knowledge production and thinking. And So we want to build on our current strengths, and we want everyone to be at the table. The next slide, please. The piece about accountability has, you know, has one dimension of sort of keeping ourselves accountable, of course, is in how we maintain metrics or how we create metrics that that feel just, that feel appropriate, that are appropriate, and how they're sort of, you know, they are. I mean, that we're all in agreement with it and that we build on it. So Cornell has started since the early 2000s to maintain information and data, even before that, but very systematically since the early 2000s, they've been maintaining data on four dimensions of diversity and inclusion. And one of them is, of course, compositional diversity, and there are various offices that sort of follow these numbers, right? At one level, looking at compositional diversity, we seem to be doing okay, and at another level, we do not. And so there's a lot of issues around how we parse the data and how we understand it, but we wanted to bring this up because we think that when the accountability piece has to, you know, when we take it sort of quite seriously, we need to look at how we collect information, how we compare information, and how we begin to understand if we're doing a good job or not. So we just wanted to show you the extent of sort of data that's being collected and where it sits right now in the university. So primarily it sits in IRP, the Office of Research and Planning, but the graduate school collects data, and you know, the HR function of the university collects data on questions of climate in particular with both staff and faculty. Next slide, please. So I'm going to switch it back to Charlie to talk about the educational programs.
Okay, thanks, Anima. So these are, again, are just very, very preliminary thoughts about the other two parts of the initiative that we're looking at. Next slide, Jill. So here are just some things regarding an educational requirement for students. So first of all, I think it's good to have a deadline. Of course, you may not make it, but I think the target here is that we'll assemble a committee very soon, and that by more or less the beginning of December, something shows up in the Senate. Okay, and again, the scope and the content of this requirement is all up for grabs. Here's the hard fact of life, which is to say that students and faculty are already book salad, the former with course requirements, the latter with broad commitments to research, teaching, and service. So the challenge is, how do you get into that? How do you embed this requirement into everyday life, so to speak? So the time requirement, the book solid issue, it has to be dealt with. There are obvious nearby programs that are of great interest. One is the Intergroup Dialogue Project that shows up in the freshman in the orientation, freshman writing seminar, Engage Cornell. And there's a huge amount of activity and we're becoming more and more aware of it in the colleges and the units, okay? And so all this has to be assimilated and we have to assess how it might relate to some university-wide requirement. Next slide, please. So one thing you get to real quickly is whether you're talking about a single course, which seems to be logistically very hard to deliver. And if you don't have that, then you get into the menu business. And you can also get in the menu business where each college does their own thing, but hopefully there's some overarching criteria. Whenever you have a menu, then you have to have rules about how do you get on the menu. So it's, again, the takeaway here is the complexity of this. And finally, I think Martha just mentioned students in her July memo. And I think the focus up kind of has been at the undergraduate level. You know, we have to deal with the six colleges, their graduation requirements, and so on. However, the content of that requirement, whatever we determine it to be, will have relevance to graduate and professional students. But the delivery system will have to be totally different. Okay, instead of six colleges, you now have 90 or 100 different degree programs. So very much on the radar is the graduate student scene, but it's a very different way of realizing the university-wide requirement. Now, just briefly about the faculty's end of this. So I'm sure you, next slide, Jill, please. You all know that in the Office of Faculty Development and Diversity is a huge array of programs and resources. I mean, it's really, really impressive. And the question is, how can we take advantage of that? The key thing here is the word required faculty training, okay? And which prompts a considerable blowback from faculty. You don't just want a program that preaches to the choir, so to speak. So that's a major challenge. And there's also a reality with some research to support it that if you drag people into a program or a session or a course or a workshop, then whatever bias that was there tends to get solidified. So we have to think hard about those dynamics. I should say that the staff are a little further along on this than we are, so to speak. They have, with eCornell, the development of this glanced at it, four or five different courses that are going to be part of the required training thing for staff. I'm not saying it's all relevant to us, but I'm just saying we should pay attention and learn from them as appropriate. Next, please. Nima mentioned accountability, and that really is an important thing. And what I want to do is engage two of our committees that oversee processes that where accountability shows up or can show up and maybe should show up in a heightened profile way. One is the AFPSF committee that looks at the tenure review process all the way from hiring, starting with hiring and so on. And to think a little bit more maybe about the role of student letters or whatever, how can we strengthen our tenure process so that we inspire ethical behavior amongst the faculty. I mentioned tenure, but we could talk about any promotion, RTE, full, associate to full, same arguments apply. So we want to look at that. And so I'll engage that committee. Kick it up a notch. Instead of individuals, now you talk about departments. Every department is reviewed about every 10 years. I know that's a long time. However, I want to look carefully with Avery August, who oversees this process, to see if we can improve that review process in a way that, again, inspires ethical behavior, accountability. How do you handle these difficult situations that come to light and so on? So I'm just saying there are a couple of avenues that I want to explore with colleagues. And those are Senate-related committees. I think is that the last slide, Jill? So let me just pause here. We have some time for questions. I know this is a sort of a breezy overview. I wanted to make sure that you understand how we're approaching this and that the next time we meet, we intend to have, I'll put it in quotes, a teach-in
There's another slide.
Oh, sorry. Okay, there is another slide. Oh,
yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. So next time we meet, the ad hoc committee for the course requirements should be set up and going. I'll be able to report on some preliminary chit chats with these two committees. And then we're working with various groups. That slide Nima had there of all the different centers and programs and whatever. We're going to, from that group, trying to figure out how we can spend some time in the next meeting just to educate ourselves about this whole scene. So that's in 3 weeks. And so that's sort of what we're working on. So again, it's just simply, we want to make sure that you see exactly what we're doing at all time. There is a website brewing and it'll be up there and we'll be able to post comments and more gracefully share with you what we're doing. But right now, if you have any questions or advice to us, you can either raise your hand now or put them in chat or of course, contact us in the usual way. Okay, there we go. Risa?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for all the work on this. Just wanted to emphasize something that Nima talked about that I think is so important here, and that is the issue of resources. Because we have, you know, really excellent programs, as you pointed out, you know, with the partial list on campus that are dealing with various aspects of inequality, you know, institutional inequality, systemic sorts of inequalities around race and gender and class and all those intersections. And they are always fighting for resources, you know. And so I think that what's very important, this is not a critique at all of what we've just heard, it's simply emphasizing that the point is to make institutional changes, as Nima said, that are lasting rather than this sort of response to protests that turn out to be very, discouraging when they feel like they're more lip service and, you know, public relations as opposed to genuinely institutional change and resources. Individual issues are very important. And, you know, I think that I don't like the term training. I like the term education. I don't do training. We do education. And so it seems to me that educating each other, educating ourselves, educating our students, all of those, and students educating us and each other. No, that's about education. So that's extremely important. But what I really want to emphasize here is that institutional commitment to resources that already, of resources to the programs that already exist. You know, whether we need another center or not, you know, I don't know. But I do know that we need better advocacy for the programs that are not getting the sort of resources that they should have because of the important work that they're doing.
No, thank you. That's a good point. Under the heading of how we package all this great talent we have on campus, gets right to the heart of it. How can we multiply the strength, their level of commitment and activity through whatever, what we're calling the center in quotes. Mark Lewis, then David Delchance. Mark?
Thank you for recognizing me, Charlie. So two quick things. The first thing is, I'm not sure if Avery has done this, but it might be a good idea to have him come present on a regular basis on activities that the Office of Faculty Diversity and Development are doing. So if they, and I'd be particularly interested in things that they've done in response to those reports that were generated a couple of years ago. That's the first thing. And the second thing is I want to mention that the slide before the one that's on the screen now, I think that's the one before that, you mentioned accountability potentially occurring at the tenure time and at the time for promotion. That generally only covers about 12 years, and we need something that is kind of makes accountability throughout the career. All right, that's all. Thank you.
That's right. Yeah. So the timing of these things, the spacing is important. Sort of an analogous timeline thing is you can't just show up in freshman orientation, do a 3-hour thing, and say that's it. There has to be a sustained thing. And of course, you know, the annual SIP letters and all that kind of stuff. There are opportunities to refine the dialogue and so on. Let's do David Delchamps. Then we actually have to move on. I want to make sure we have enough time to hear the students. So David Delchamps, did you have your hand up?
Yeah. Just quickly,
I just want to make sure that we maintain the focus on the race part of this, and we don't let it get into human difference, you know, gender stuff and whatever. I mean, those are all important, but I think that this is really, we really need to keep the focus on the race part of this, honestly, to tell you the truth. I think that's what the Do Better Cornell folks want to hear from us, and I think we should do that. That's my opinion.
Good point, and thanks. Ken, if you can be really, really quick.
Yeah, Ken Berman, computer science. I was just wondering if we might consider restarting the freshman book project, but doing it around this topic.
That's obviously on the table. That's a big common denominator thing that you can do at the start of the semester, and maybe the start of both semesters. Okay, very good. Thanks a lot. Let's now get on to the last part of the meeting. Next slide, please. So you all are familiar by now with the behavioral compact. A lot of the concern is about enforcement and whatever, and what's the university doing when they see bad behavior and so on. But I think we all know that more effective is to inspire good behavior. And also, so I wanted to hear from students in the trenches. You can easily read about the various programs that they are part of, but I'd like to have them talk very, it's from a personal point of view. I said, look, this, what are you seeing? What do you think about the behavioral compact? Are you optimistic? Why are you doing this? All that kind of stuff. I want to begin with Mark Maley, who's an MPH student, and he's part of a group of students from that program who are doing surveys on campus to find out how students think, well, how anyone in the street thinks about this stuff. So Brian, how about it?
Thank you for that introduction, Charlie. So since late July, we in the MPH program, 19 students, myself included, supervised by MPH faculty, have been systematically going to various locations on campus and conducting these semi-structured interviews using Qualtrics surveys to get a sense for the percentage of people on campus who are adhering to prevention behaviors such as social distancing and mask wearing. We're also trying to understand what factors motivate or limit those behaviors and gather input and ideas to inform or improve processes and practices on campus and off campus if mentioned. So throughout the course of these kind of semi-structured interviews, we've talked to now all just about 600 people now, with 90% or about 90% of the respondents wearing masks, and the same about 90% also choosing to physically distant from one another. And one of the interesting observations, or some of the results that we've gotten, are fairly overwhelmingly positive results. You know, when approaching people who aren't wearing masks, asking them the question, you know, why aren't you, you know, is, you know, can you explain why you aren't wearing a mask? A lot of the responses that we get are that, you know, they're with people that they know and trust, they forgot, or that they're outside and the risk feels low. But the overwhelming responses that we get from people who are wearing the mask is that they want to protect others and they feel a strong sense of community, and that they want to, you know, prevent COVID transmission on campus. Some of the facilitators to people wearing masks were, you know, just generally being around others and a desire to follow the rules. Other barriers to mask wearing that we found overwhelmingly was discomfort, either physical or kind of social discomfort, general awkwardness. But a lot of people said it's the heat, you know, wearing the mask is physically uncomfortable, and that's why they're not. And for the 90% of respondents, or about 90% of respondents who had been complying with social distancing guidelines, they stated that signage and rules, knowledge of rules, were the biggest reasons for them following those guidelines. And for those that were not distancing, it was because they were with roommates or with colleagues or with people that they spend a lot of time with and tend to trust. Other barriers for that include, obviously, crowded spaces, and so on. But in my kind of more observational experience going around campus and conducting these surveys, or these interviews, rather, is that people really want to comply with these and are very interested in, one, talking to me and the other interviewers about their thoughts and feelings about this, but that they really, like I said, have a strong sense of community and a desire to comply with these guidelines to, you know, for one another, and so that they can continue with their Cornell experience as best as they possibly can.
Thanks, Brian. Would anyone like to pose a question to Brian before we go on to the other students? Anyone want to? There's some preliminary or an abstract of some data up on the website if you want to take a look at some of the percents associated with the various questions. Okay,
I see the question, how were student respondents selected? So we were selecting every 10th person in a space. So going out either selected, you know, standing by a doorway outside or kind of walking through an indoor space in a building and just picking every 10th person. Obviously, when we were starting this back in July, there were way fewer people on campus, so we were trying to get as many people as we could, but we were trying to make it as random as possible. Yes, okay. Random sampling.
Okay, thanks, Brian. When I'll talk to three undergraduates, there are two programs out there. Next slide, please, Joe. One's called Peer Ambassadors, and these are students who are out in the field, so to speak. They're you see them under tents, they're on campus. They more behind the scenes, they interact with clubs and their own circle of contacts and so on. And they number in the hundreds, I believe. The peer consultants serve as a sounding board. They interact with Cornell Health and the public health fellows that are there, reviewing policies and whatever. So a lot of the policies you see coming out of Cornell Health and other places do have a student input component to them. But again, remember what I want here is I just ask these students, what do you see? What are you thinking about? Why are you doing this? So let's start with Kaylee. Kaylee's, as you can see, is majoring in global and public health science. Kaylee, why don't you tell us what you think of this whole business?
Hi, thank you, Dean Van Loan, for that introduction. I'm a coordinator for the COVID Peer Ambassador Program that you guys see on campus. And we're mainly here for like a positive structure for students to utilize. Like we have tents set up all over campus and like different locations such as like West Campus, Baker Flagpole, College Town, Ag Quad, 626 Thurston, and McGraw Tower. So like all over campus. And we give out free supplies for students that just want to grab like a mask or some hand sanitizer and stuff like that to promote like the best, like the safest measures on campus. And we spread words of like social distancing through like multiple social media campaigns like we have planned, such as like the importance of wearing a mask, certain things like tips for like studying with friends or like trying to hang out with friends, and other things like mental health, like tips for happiness and stuff, because that's also a big issue on campus right now. And so we're mainly just here for positive, like spreading positive messages. We're different from the thing that's called behavioral compact monitors, which is mainly faculty and staff who are roving like around campus to ensure that everyone's wearing their masks and like practicing social distancing. So that's like a separate entity from us. And we're transitioning to something called roving ambassadors, where we're gonna have students walking around campus with bags, and they're going to be handing out supplies to people they see that might like have forgotten their mask or something like that. And we think this has been people have been responding to this like very well. Like people are very optimistic. We see that majority of people walking around campus are wearing masks and doing this social distancing stuff that's Cornell has been requiring, because I feel like everyone wants to like be safe and like have a successful semester on campus. I don't think anyone is like outly trying to like disregard these rules because we all are like in it together as a community, like Brian previously said. So yeah, that's basically it.
Thanks, Kaylee.
Yeah.
And the same program is Brian Walker, and then maybe we'll get some questions. So Brian, from your point of view, what are you seeing? Are you more optimistic today than you were like 2 weeks ago or vice versa? Just tell us what you're thinking.
Okay, thank you for the introduction, Dean Van Loan. So I'm one of the peer ambassadors on campus this semester that Kaylee described. And as to why I think a lot of people are peer ambassadors this semester, just to answer what you said before, Dean Van Loan, Kaylee said it very well that virtually all the students here like care very deeply about their time and their Cornell experience. And I think people are really willing to like adopt a culture of shared responsibility for that. And I've seen a lot of that around campus, both as a peer ambassador and just as a student and a peer of the thousands of other students that came back to campus. And you said about optimism. For now, I am very optimistic. I think the students care very deeply and are willing to like uphold each other to a very high standard of behavior. I think the best examples of this are people like really spending a lot of time outside, eating outside, distancing, mask wearing. And when people don't have masks, like no one's afraid to go and try to get one or reach out and stuff like that. So I'd say I am very optimistic.
So another question both for Kaylee and Brian. So we're only at the 1 week point in the semester. I know for faculty it's very hard to focus on your regular job like research and so on. How hard do you find it doing schoolwork? I mean, how much of a space in your head does all this stuff occupy, and does it make it hard for you to sort of do the academics?
Yes. So I think most Cornell students, since we're all here, are very serious about their studies and they're very willing to prioritize their studies. But it's definitely a thought in the back of our heads, I think, to speak for the student body, I guess, especially with the significant reduction in in-person classes. Like personally, I have like two lectures a week in person. So spending a lot of time in my room, just like online lectures, a lot of Zoom. I definitely think about that. But for the most part, I'd say we can focus on our studies.
Really?
Yeah. Sort of like adding on to what Brian said, it definitely is like a thought in the back of our head because like obviously this semester is something we've never really experienced before and things are so different. Like he said, he's only taking like two online or in-person classes. I actually don't have any in-person as of now. So I am spending like a significant amount of time like in my dorm, which like I could say like for me and like others, it could take like a potential like massive toll on your mental health if you're just in your room by yourself all day instead of like prior semesters when you can be out and about like all the time. So relating this to like academics, I do say like it is a thought out there that should be like taken into consideration when like talking about academics, because it might be like easier to focus given that like it's the only thing that we have to do if like you're in your room by yourself. But there are many other factors that like we should like weigh into that equation.
Thank you. I think it's really important to hear directly from students these sorts of thoughts. It's really, well, let's go on. Thank you. Samantha Nolan is a peer consultant and they sort of advise individuals in Cornell Health about policy and so on. Samantha, are you there? And let's hear what you're thinking about nowadays.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for having us. Yeah, so I got involved with the program actually from the early stages when I first heard about the ambassadors and consultants, which originally were all under one title, and then kind of split off. I wanted to get involved because I know this is such a privilege to be able to come back to campus. And I actually have all in-person classes because it was a huge motivating factor for me to return. And I know that they may transition to online at some point, but it's been really successful so far in the classroom. And I've seen really great people wearing their masks, people keeping physical distancing, and the professors are doing an amazing job. And I'd say as a peer consultant, the program actually is just gearing up. First, the ambassador program was rolled out to kind of get people on the ground handing things out. And then the peer consultants are going to have our first meeting with everyone this week. And we've worked closely with Laura Santa Croce in Cornell Health, a small group of students from the start, kind of building what the messaging was going to be and exactly how do you inspire people in all different cross-sections of campus life, whether it be athletics or Greek life or clubs or anything really, or arts organizations. How do you inspire people to do these measures? And I think what I've been seeing even before the official program has begun its meetings is that students, as others have said, really are finding this to be a privilege to be back on campus when so many universities and colleges couldn't open their doors. And I feel the same way. And I think that also students, when they do have an in-person class or some in-person classes, feel this extra responsibility because we're going to be interfacing with professors and other members of the community. And I think, but really most people I'd say I talk to really care a lot. And the whole idea behind the consultants is to really influence others because it would be like the cool thing to do. If most people are doing it, that'll just become the campus culture. And how can we shift campus culture into this safe way of doing things when it's counter to our intuition and counter to how we normally do things on campus? So that's mostly the goal behind it.
Thank you. So one thing that there's sort of daytime behavior, and I must say, like when I'm stuck here in my basement for days on end, I get really jaded. But then I go for a walk on campus during the day, and it's really inspiring to see students going to class and the high compliance with the rules and so on. But what about nighttime? So none of these programs, I know Brian mentioned that there was no survey at night. You know, we're worried about the nighttime, right? You hear the parties and all that kind of stuff. Is there what about that whole scene? Is there an opportunity for peer ambassadors? And do you consider these sorts of things in the peer consultant group?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think, so in that compact, in order to sign the compact and return to campus, you had to watch a series of videos. And I did help in creating some of the ideas behind one of the videos, which was about a party situation and like community spread and how if someone goes to a party, you know, they may think they're fine, and then, but little do they know they have the virus, and then everybody around them sort of showing how it can spread throughout the community to different compromised people with immunocompromised health situations. And I think that's just sort of a messaging campaign. But as far as the actual in real life situation, I have, you know, talked to people about, well, what are you doing socially? Because, you know, people do have to have some social life. You know, people, it's, as we said, it's not really healthy to be alone all the time. So, you know, gathering in really small groups outside. I see a lot of people, you know, eating outside on the slope, eating outside on, you know, North Campus in Rawlings Green, playing a game of catch, things like that. But I, you know, as far as the parties that we heard about, it's, there are this small group of people that some people had parties, and that unfortunately has created some community spread. And now there's this fear of, you know, going to code yellow and everything, so that we already are in, and then maybe it getting worse. So I think the problem with the situation is even a couple people having a party could create a big outbreak. So I think that's why there's that added element of fear that even if everyone is complying, if one or two people say, let's have a party, and there's this one party, it could end up throwing the thing, whole thing off. So I think that's why, you know, trying to influence as many people as possible is important.
Okay, any other comments, either from the students or faculty? I see some questions on the chat about the dashboard, and I know that's been kind of a hot topic the last couple of days. Here is sort of what I know about it. The question is, why was there the lull in reporting over the weekend and so on? And it had to do with, they wanted to reformat the statistics that were displayed so that one could judge better how close we are to Governor Cuomo's threshold. I know there was some redesign of it, but there are concerns about the dashboard, and if anyone would like to bring that up. Do students, do you monitor the dashboard daily? Is that part of, when you get up in the morning, is that the first thing you look at, or?
Charlie, while we're waiting for people to respond to whether they monitor the dashboard daily, I thought I'd just respond to a couple of issues raised about students new to Cornell and transfer students, I think to Susan Quirk, who asked about it. I'm a dean on West Campus, and I know there are others on this call who are faculty in residence or deans. And we've always had we've always had programs directed towards transfer students. For example, you know, a house like Becker will have at least 40 to 60, sometimes 70 transfer students coming in out of 380 or so. So we always have programs, and that's something that we've continued. So, you know, using, it's quite remarkable actually to see students sort of participating through things like Yammer and Discord and stuff like that. And as you might also know, the Dean of Students has launched an entire series of online programming for people new to Cornell, for first years, as well as other students. There's virtual escape rooms that are hugely attended. There's a lot of stuff that's going on. And so you can find all that on a website. I can't remember the name of it. Samantha, Kaylee, I don't know if any of you, Brian, any of the two Brians know of that site off the top of your head. But it's happening. It's not easy, but it's happening.
Campus groups, yeah. Jenny Loffelman just put it in. Campus groups.
Yep. And I know there's been a group of staff, I'm, you know, Jenny's on this call, who've done amazing amounts of work along with faculty to try sort of put things together, and students like Samantha and Kaylee and Brian on the call.
Okay. Maybe it's time to wrap up, but I'd like to really thank the four students. What you're doing is really extremely important, and it's very important for us to hear firsthand what you're about your experience. And we're really thankful that you were able to come today, and we want to wish you the very best for the rest of the semester and all that you're doing to help keep the place going. So thank you very much. And I guess we'll end the meeting now. We do the usual hallway stuff. That is to say, we turn off the recording and you can hang around and chit chat if you'd like. I will, and Nemo will, and so